Shrink Wrap Radio number 384, Women and Wine, Her Best Kept Secret, with Gabrielle Glazer.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with journalist Gabrielle Glazer, and we'll be speaking about dramatic cultural changes in the relationship of women to alcohol. Gabrielle Glazer grew up in Tangent, Oregon, the grass seed capital of the world. She spent her teenage summers driving John Deere combines on her family farm, listening to an unusual mix of local radio programming, the Bee Gees, Marvin Gaye, Johnny Cash, and NPR. She was an indifferent member of her local 4-H sewing club, and her nearest neighbors were her grandparents. After high school, she attended Stanford University, where she received a bachelor's and master's degree in history. She started her journalistic career as a news assistant at the New York Times in Washington, D.C. She worked as a reporter at the Associated Press in Baltimore, Maryland, and Warsaw, Poland. From Eastern Europe, she also reported for The Economist, The Dallas Morning News, The Village Voice, and National Public Radio. Since the late 1990s, Glazer has examined social, cultural, and national health trends for The New York Times, The New York Times Magazine, and The Oregonian in Portland, where she was a staff writer. She worked as a County Lines columnist at The New York Times, and her work has appeared in many publications, including the New York Times Magazine, Glamour, Mademoiselle, and ScientificAmerican.com. She taught feature writing at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism and won the Missouri Lifestyle Journalism Award for her groundbreaking work exploring international and interracial adoption. Before her latest book, Her Best Kept Secret, she wrote Strangers to the Table, Portraits of Interfaith Marriage, and The Nose, A Profile of Sex, Beauty, and Survival. She appears frequently as a commentator and a guest on local and national television and radio. Now, here's the interview. Gabrielle Glazer, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, I'm really glad to have you on the show. I love the way you start your book off in the prologue. The very first sentence is, "My name is Gabrielle, and I'm not an alcoholic."
And
I thought that was a really punchy beginning. And even though you could conclude that you're not an alcoholic, you did go through some soul searching about your own relationship to alcohol in the process of working on the book. So maybe that's a good place for us to start.
You know, I think you're giving me more credit than is due when you say soul searching. I went through a period of, and you know, by the way, I enjoy drinking. I look forward to it. I'm a regular drinker. I'm a moderate drinker. But during a period of really high stress, a cross-country move, moving from the West Coast to the East Coast, resettling three children, selling one house, buying another, saying goodbye to my family. My mother-in-law was dying, and she lived nearby, and she had been molested in the nursing home where she was. I mean,
oh,
it was a lot.
Goodness.
It was a lot, and there was a lawsuit involved. I mean, it was a lot of stress. And I found myself at night pouring myself an uncharacteristic third glass of wine for a couple of weeks. And I realized at one point I was out walking the dog and people were in the house, you know, prospective buyers were in the house looking at it, and I was so anxious and I thought, well, okay, 15 minutes and I can have a glass of wine. It was 4:45. And I just laughed out loud because it was so absurd. A glass of wine at 5 o'clock was not going to change any of the paradigm, any of the situation in which I found myself. It was not going to help one single bit. The reality was still going to be that I was moving, that it was painful, that I had so much to do. And in fact, the alcohol actually made me less functional. So I just stopped drinking for a month. It wasn't hard, and I have been very careful ever since.
Well, had you already started work on the book at that point?
Oh, no, I hadn't. No, I hadn't. That was in 2008, and I got the contract for the book about more than a year later, actually about 2 years later. And the idea for the book kind of came to me as I had a conversation with a friend who's an editor, and we both noticed that all around us women were drinking more. And she said, why don't you look into that? So it wasn't something that I generated. I wish I could take credit for the idea, but I can't, because it was really generated by a conversation I had with a really smart woman who's my editor.
Yeah, a smart woman indeed, because I think you really unearthed some important trends that are worth calling out. And again, going back to your intro in which you say, I'm not an alcoholic, you suggest that your book is actually a unique contribution in women writing about alcohol, because the other notable books in this area have been written by women who were alcoholics.
Absolutely.
Yeah, say a little bit more about that.
Well, most of the, you know, we have a paradigm in this country with regard to alcohol that really the only people who truly understand the devastation of alcohol and alcohol dependence are the people who themselves have experienced it. And while I'm not discounting those experiences, I learned in the course of researching this book that it's really sort of a monopoly. The idea that, and I hesitate to use the word alcoholic because I don't, that word is not used in science anymore. It hasn't been used in science for 20 years.
What do they use instead?
Well, the first term in 1994, the DSM-4 replaced alcoholism with alcohol abuse and alcohol dependence, and the DSM-5 gave a subtler distinction to that, you know, an even subtler distinction to that, and now it's called alcohol use disorder. Alcoholism is something that was a term really popularized by Alcoholics Anonymous, and it really, to me, has the idea of you might as well just have an invisible hopeless in parentheses before the word alcoholic, because that really kind of implies a devastating, surefire, absolute end. If this person continues to drink, they will end up in the gutter, in prison, or dead.
Yeah. Now, we're getting a little bit ahead. I definitely want to drill down into Alcoholics Anonymous, and but I'm interested in some of the earlier parts of your book, and you've already mentioned that you moved from the West Coast to the East Coast, and so you kind of notice some things about the women that you knew, women that you observed, and there were some interesting things going on in relation to women and alcohol.
Absolutely. I noticed a big change from the early 90s. I have three daughters, and my first daughter was born in 1992. And when I got together with other mothers who also worked, nobody was talking about having I'll meet you for a drink, or we'll have a mommy play date. Well, the kids play, we're going to have wine. And again, this is just my experience, but it wasn't, it never came up. I don't remember a single time in which it came up. And when I had my third daughter in 2001, and at that time I did live on the East Coast in the New York suburbs, I had her in the fall of 2001. Obviously, New York area had been devastated. The town where I lived lost 9 men in the towers, and it was an exceptionally anxious time. But even so, as a baby gift, I got bottle after bottle after bottle of wine as a baby gift. And
not the baby.
Yeah, for me. I wasn't even drinking. And it just, the implication was, you know what? you're going to need a lot of this. And I chalked it up to the anxiety of the time and place, but not long after that, I moved to Portland, Oregon, where I'm from, and I noticed that women in that extremely relaxed city were bending elbows with the exact same enthusiasm that they had been in stressed out New York City.
Yeah, that I found fascinating. And your book is based not just on your own personal observations. You actually got deeper into researching the material for the book, and you discovered that, in fact, a major cultural shift has taken place, at least here in the United States, in relation to women and alcohol. And when would you say that shift began?
Well, and I did do a lot of research about women's drinking, and it's a little tricky to pinpoint the exact time, because women and alcohol were not technically even included in federal alcohol studies until the 1990s, if you can believe that. There were a few here and there, but in general, it was sort of the Adam's Rib theory, that if this is true for men, then it's got to be true for women.
Yeah, and you also describe in your book how researchers threw away data from women when they had
Absolutely.
It because it kind of complicated the picture.
Exactly. Their hormones complicated things. They didn't answer the same questions as they didn't answer the questions the way that men did, so they just tossed them out.
That is the shocking.
It's shocking, isn't it? It really is shocking. And it fit male heavy drinkers fit a trajectory that really, and this is bad science, but it really seemed to mirror what the researchers expected to see up until certainly through the 50, certainly through the 50s and 60s, and one lone researcher from the University of North Carolina, she was at Harvard at the time, I mean not North Carolina, North Dakota, her name is Sharon Wilsnack, and she was the first woman in the United States to even raise her hand at a psychology graduate course at Harvard in 1970 and say, you know what? We're studying human motivations for drinking here, but there's not a single woman in this study. It should be called male motivations for drinking. And not a single professor had even noticed. It was a vast study over years and years of time interviewing college fraternity brothers about their drinking habits, when they were drinking, after they'd been drinking, after they were super drunk. And not a single woman had ever even been included in the study. And that was... Well, that's human.
Yes.
Yeah, it's human, but it's male human.
male blindness.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So really, it wasn't until the 90s when women started being included. Remember the big heart study, brouhaha? You know how women's heart attack symptoms were different from male heart attack symptoms, but women had... were repeatedly sent home from emergency rooms as just having panic attacks when, in fact, they'd had heart attacks.
Oh, wow.
Because their symptoms differed from men. That was a big study, I think, in the 1990s, and researchers kind of got the message, hey, you know what, we do this in a lot of areas.
Yeah.
So to answer your question, that's a very long answer to your question about what we know is this. Between the early 1990s and 2007, the number of women who were arrested for drunk driving went up 30%. The level of male drunk driving arrests, stayed flat. The number of middle-aged women who checked into rehab between 1992 and also 2007 nearly tripled. The number of women under 30 showing up in hospitals for being dangerously intoxicated almost doubled between the early 90s and the mid 2000s or mid aughts. So those were some figures that really detailed a disturbing trend.
Yes.
And
go ahead.
No, and while it's those numbers are, they're certainly solid. We know that that's, you cannot argue with the number of hospitalizations, people coming to get their stomachs pumped. And by the way, men stayed flat and even dropped. The number of men who overdrink, and this is, you know, mostly young people under 30, as I said, that stayed flat. In some cases, I think it even dropped, and women's just went up, nearly, you know, almost 100%. So yeah, that's pretty disturbing.
You know, one of my buddies just returned from a college visit where his daughter had just been enrolled, and the level of drinking and alcohol that he saw there was really quite shocking. And you know, that people put funnels in their mouths and whole bottles are poured in, and just, and it's become such a ritual on campuses.
Right.
Yeah, and the spring breaks, of course, are notorious for what happens in Florida and elsewhere. And yet, and you sort of, I think, went into this with that sort of expectation. But one of the things you found was that it wasn't just young women who were abusing
alcohol. Absolutely. And that was surprising to me also, because as a journalist, I had covered, you know, many stories of young women on spring break and drinking and, you know, waking up someplace in Mexico. They didn't even know where they were. And that's just what I assumed the numbers would bear out. But what really surprised me was that the numbers indicated a real shift in the drinking habits of older women, middle-aged women, women over 35, between 35 and 54. And on one hand, it wasn't that surprising because it's what I had observed. But when you are a journalist, you really reach for the numbers to substantiate what it is you're observing, so you don't write some phony trend piece. And this isn't a phony trend. Also, you know, the buyers of wine in this country are overwhelmingly women, and that's another thing that has shifted in the past
yes.
couple of decades.
Yeah, and And another thing that kind of emerges in a fascinating way in your book is that when it comes to women and alcohol, it turns out that it's largely a story about wine.
Right. The winemakers, after Prohibition was lifted, really had to kind of get their wineries in gear, and they were desperate for new buyers and to increase the market. And Americans in the 30s and 40s saw wine as an immigrant drink. It was for the Skid Row bombs. It was for, that's what Italians did. That's what Greeks did. That's what Jews did at the Sabbath table. That's not us. That wasn't American. We came from a culture in which beer and hard cider were our national drinks. After that, whiskey. Every home on the frontier had a distillery throughout the 1840s. And Americans drank a lot. They drank a lot of beer and they drank a lot of spirits.
Yeah, even the founding fathers, you noted, you gave some of that
and
history.
And the first lady. I'm looking at my bookshelf, and she had a recipe book of 500 recipes that she left for her granddaughter as a wedding gift. And 50 of those recipes, literally a tenth of them, were for boozy drinks. And there are about a half dozen hangover cures as well. So Martha Washington liked to party.
This is not an image that has come down to us.
No, it has not. We have the idea that she was this, you know, fusty kind of Mrs. Claus-like lady,
yeah.
And she was a hottie. There are some images of her that the public never had. We just didn't get that image. We had that. We have that view of her in her nightcap, and the day she married George, she was a widow with four children. She was absolutely stunningly beautiful. She wore silk, purple silk shoes with sequins on them, and a gorgeous purple low-cut dress. And
wow.
She liked to to live it up. She really did.
There was a plate in the book. A photo
Yes, an image of her, yes.
And I had to look and relook and say, now, wait a second, is this her? Is this Martha Washington? I mean, she was a hottie in that image.
Exactly. And she was. That was an image of her as rendered by a very talented artist who lives in New Orleans. But there was some documentation was unearthed at Mount Vernon about 5 or 10 years ago that really cast her in a new light.
Hmm. So, and as you got into the story about wine, and I want you to continue that that trajectory, but it was of particular interest to me, in as much as I live in the heart of the California wine country, and parenthetically, it's with some embarrassment that I confess I'm not really very much into wine, and people always assume that because I live in Sonoma County that I'll be a real connoisseur and I know what to order in the restaurant and so on.
Right.
But I'm not, and so I was intrigued about your account. And I think this is, you were just getting into this, that initially the American public in general was rather averse to wine. They didn't like the taste of it even. And that the California wineries really had to mount a major campaign to get America hooked on wine.
They did. And I don't want to paint them to say that they're like the cigarette companies and try, you know, wine in moderation is good for us. It's the Spanish, the Italians, the French consume 3 times what Americans consume and they live longer. So there's something we're doing differently and we can get to that later. But, you know, wine is not the bad guy. I think it's how women are drinking and the reasons they're drinking and the manner in which they're drinking. And it is typically wine because it's so socially acceptable that is unhealthy. But the wine industry, as I started to say, was very, very interested in expanding its market. And one way that they did that was to find people who were naturally adventuresome. They found gourmet clubs in New York City. They found ski groups in Colorado and at Lake Tahoe. They found travel groups, in Chicago. And they thought, well, these are people who are going to be really interested in trying new things. So let's do tastings with them. And typically these are people who are, they're called first adopters. They're kind of trendsetters. And if we get wine into the hands of these folks, they'll help spread the word. They also were helped by Julia Child, who was on television and drank wine liberally and encouraged Americans to drink wine liberally as well. And the wine industry worked very closely with her, again, a California native, to try to promote California winery. And California at the time, especially in the 1960s and early 70s, was in the golden state, as you know, the Beach Boys and the surfing culture and the coolness of Hollywood was really something Americans wanted a part of. And the wine industry in the Bay Area and in the wine country decided, well, okay, they can have their Hollywood, they can have their Disneyland, but we're going to create a different, more refined universe up here. Many of the vintners were Italian Americans, and they said, we're going to make this a more European experience. We're going to hark back to our ancestors and the countries of our forefathers, and this is how we are going to position wine. Wine is part of a good life. Wine is part of good living. It's part of California living. It's part of a sunny lifestyle. And they were very successful in promoting that ideal and promoting that little bit of California sunshine in a bottle that you could get at your, you know, at a wine store in snowy Minneapolis. You may not be able to have look out at the beautiful ocean for dinner, but you could have a little bit of that California magic on your dinner table.
Mm-hmm. And now we have wine bars. That's an interesting phenomenon that's happened in recent years.
Absolutely, yes. Where the wine bars are really, again, they're geared toward women. Come enjoy a glass or two with your girlfriends after work, girls' night out. There's a lot of girls' night out emphasis in the female drinking culture. And the spirits companies have really taken a page from the wine marketers, and they really aggressively market to women. Now, one thing we started to touch on it, Americans didn't like wine because they were used to the drinks that they'd had during Prohibition, which were sugary cocktails. They were super sweet, you know, like gimlets and rum and coke.
I got sick on gimlets, and I've never been able, when I was much younger, I've never been able to drink gin since then.
You know, I've never been able to drink tequila for the exact same reason. Uh-huh. I had too many margaritas at one point, and ever since then, the thought of the smell is enough to just make me ill.
Exactly.
But Americans had this very sugary palate, and it took a while, but eventually the vintners came up with a wine, in particular Chardonnay, that was easy to say. Nobody was intimidated to say Chardonnay. It sounded pretty, sounded feminine. It tasted a little bit like apple pie. There were vanilla notes and kind of, you know, spicy notes, and it was kind of buttery. It was velvety to the tongue. And if you recall, in the 1980s, you couldn't swing a dead cat without, you know, getting a snout full of Chardonnay at some wine and cheese party somewhere. I mean, it was just ubiquitous.
You know, earlier you used the phrase girls' night out, and one of my favorite observations is your comment that in a relatively short period of time, we went from prohibitionist Carrie Nation to Carrie Bradshaw of Sex and the City.
Yeah, absolutely. Less than 100 years.
Yeah.
Carrie Nation died in 1911, and Carrie Bradshaw was, you know, a cultural icon in the late 1990s and early 2000s. So, yeah, that really, I was really struck by that. And that kind of alcohol as a reward for the end of a stressful day was really, it's impossible, of course, to peg female drinking to television shows, but it certainly was portrayed as something that was normal and you were deserving of it, and it was fun. And all of those things are true. It's just that I think we carry it too far.
Yeah. Now, one of the historical things that you touch on in your book is the WCTU, the Women's Christian Temperance Union. So there's some, you know, talk about the shift from then to now. What was the WCTU all about?
Well, that's an interesting story. The WCTU, Women's Christian Temperance Union, was a group of women who were inspired by the ideals of the Second Revival, so the kind of a second wave Protestant churches that happened in the 19th century, and so the point was to cleanse the earth of sin in order for the second coming of Christ. And there were several ways to go about this. One was to educate women, because women were the moral arbiters when the country had shifted from the Industrial Revolution, from the Agrarian Revolution to the Industrial Revolution. Men went off and worked in factories, and the family economic unit of the farm shifted. So women were at home with one job, and that the men were the breadwinners. They were no longer the, you know, co-producers with their husband of the crops, and they were in charge of the family's morality. They were in charge of the family's religious upbringing. They were in charge of keeping everybody in line. Women were, that was their role in society, and it was believed to be divined by God, right?
Yeah.
And they wanted to, as these moral arbiters, their role was specifically to educate women so they could, you know, promote higher morals for everybody. They wanted to abolish slavery, which, of course, was a fantastic, necessary, a crucial ideal. And they wanted temperance. They wanted a prohibition of all alcohol, which they believed to be an incredible sin. Now, we have this idea that during Prohibition, before Prohibition, men were wandering like in a drunken haze on the streets of the United States, beating their wives, drinking all of their salaries, guzzling their salaries, and leaving their families destitute. Did this happen sometimes? Yes, of course it did. Did it happen in the incredible numbers that the Women's Christian Temperance Union said it did? No, it did not. That was, those were, those messages that we still hear today, oh, well, the streets were full of drunks, that was propaganda from the WCTU that passed along in ladies' magazines and some of the most influential publications of the day. The Oprah of the day was a woman who was the editor of a magazine called Godey's Ladies Book. Mm. And she promoted the serial novel of a guy who wrote about the devastation of a small town when a bar, a tavern, came to the town. And anybody who was touched by alcohol, the evil alcohol, died. Terrible things happened to their family. If anybody made a penny off this publication, if anybody made a penny off alcohol, something terrible would happen. Their kids would die. They would go blind. They'd lose their house. Their house would burn. And that was a morality lesson that basically went viral. This was a novel. And it was the most, it was called 10 Nights in a Bar Room. And that story, serialized novel, was one of the most well-read novels of all time in American history. And it was a novel. It was made up. It was, and it was then, because not everybody could read at the time, it was made into plays that toured the country in revivalist tents. And it was repeated so often that it was considered to be an absolute truth, an absolute 100%, yes, this is how it was, this is what happened. When in fact, it wasn't. Did people drink too much? Yes. Why? Because we didn't have clean water. That's why.
Ah.
You could die. You could die from the water. We didn't have water filtration. People got cholera. They got typhus from the filthy water that they drank. And really the only safe beverage until the 1840s, when we did finally get sand filtration up and down the Mississippi River, was alcohol.
Was it the WCTU then that sort of led us into Prohibition?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They found in themselves, I believe, at the end of the 18th century, 1860s or 70s, I'm not clear exactly on the dates, and finally, at the beginning of the 20th century, they really were able to help turn the tide of the American public by zeroing in on the drinking habits of immigrants. The country had absorbed enormous numbers of immigrants from very, you know, I don't want to say heavily drinking countries, but countries that drank. So the Irish, the Italians, the Greeks, all of the Germans, all drank. And this was a great offense to the Protestant ladies of the Women's Christian Temperance Union.
I didn't know that piece of it.
Yes, because, and particularly in what really happened, how it really caught fire, was after World War I, up and down the Mississippi River, along with the sand filtration, the German immigrants to this country helped bring many, many, many improvements, urban improvements, German society was both, while it was, you know, relatively agrarian, the cities were very sophisticated. And when German immigrants came to this country, they brought that sophistication with them. They brought technological advances. They brought great, their breweries that were up and down from Milwaukee, Chicago, Ohio, throughout the Ohio River Valley. They brought their breweries and their beer gardens. And the families, German immigrant families would go to beer gardens on Sundays all together, and the women in their finery would drink in front of the children, and the children would also tipple. And this drove the Women's Christian Temperance Union crazy. Likewise, so did the Italian women drinking wine with their families at dinner. So did the custom, as is customary, the small children drinking a bit of wine with water at dinner time. And they literally had spies. The WCTU had spies. They had shaming circles, but they would gather around a woman's house if they believed she drank too much, and they would shame her. They would march with posters and say, "This woman drinks. She's, you know, the daughter of the devil."
Wow.
Yeah. It was extremely aggressive. And not until the anti-immigrant tide had truly turned after World War One. So anything associated with the Germans, anything associated with a German brewery was evil. And that really is what helped pass Prohibition, along with log rolling from the dry congressmen to allow women the right to vote. So the 19th Amendment banning alcohol and the 20th Amendment allowing women the right to vote were very much connected.
This is fascinating. One of the sort of leitmotifs that I think kind of runs through the book, sometimes stated explicitly and others not, is that this country has had a kind of a double standard in relation to men and women.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very much so.
And that it really shows up in the story about alcohol and how women are perceived. Talk about the changes that have gone on over time in terms of the public perception of women and alcohol.
In the mid-1940s, Alcoholics Anonymous, we'll get to that in a minute, was very successful in promoting the idea of alcoholism as a disease for which the cure was the spiritual practice of Alcoholics Anonymous. And initially, it was open only to men. And that is because there was a very, 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 very stubborn double standard that existed for female drinkers. And female drinkers, it was men who drank were deserving of compassion because they had a disease. But women who drank were promiscuous, they were sluts, they were driven by their sex drives, they were had perversions and fetishes. And there was a book that was published in 1948 by a psychoanalyst named, I've got the book right here, Benjamin Karpman, I believe his name was. And he wrote a book called The Alcoholic Woman, in which he profiled three psychiatric inpatients at the largest and most prestigious psychiatric hospital in the country, St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C., which was also the hospital of last resort. And he decided to profile three female patients who also drank too much. And he, using the psychoanalysis that was common at the time, really drilled down into their sexual fetishes. And he concluded that one woman was an alcoholic because she really was a closeted lesbian. Another woman was an alcoholic because she was, and I use the term alcoholic in quotations since I don't use that word, and science doesn't use that word, but another woman had a drinking problem because she had penis envy, and another woman had severe alcohol dependence because she was actually she preferred oral sex to intercourse. Mm. And this was seen as an incredible perversion. And this book, believe it or not, was in print for 25 years.
Wow.
It was in print. It first had one printing and then another printing, and it wound up in mass market paperback through the 1970s. I think the last printing was 1974.
My goodness.
Exactly. And it was a book that you could get at the airport. It was one of those pulpy paperbacks that you could get, and it was complete, you know, prurient interest of the reader.
Yeah.
Because it was basically pornographic is what it was.
Yeah.
Because he described the sex acts, and I'm sure that's probably why boy people bought it. But that was so rooted in the minds of the American public that that was the definition. If you were a man.
Yeah, you also point out this double standard kind of attitude is portrayed in Hollywood films.
Absolutely. And not only Hollywood films, but also in newspapers today, in New York State, for example, there was a tragic accident in which a woman killed 8 people, including herself, her daughter, and her 3 nieces. She was totally loaded. She was driving the wrong way on a winding highway and slammed into an oncoming car, and it turned out she had a blood alcohol level of 3 times the legal limit. And initially, people really, before the toxicology report had been released, they were so sympathetic. She was the girl next door. She was a nice mom. She had a good job. She was a working wife and a good aunt. And then when the news came out, it was the tabloids had a field day and, you know, excoriating her. How could she? How could she? And the compassion turned immediately to contempt. Not long after that, another woman who had been drinking had a bunch of kids in her car. One of them was killed as a result of her drunk driving. And New York State passed a law that criminalized the driving of a child in your car when you had been drinking. Until that time, it was a misdemeanor. And in the 9 months after that law was passed, I did a quick search of the arrests for women who had been arrested under, you know, as felons under this new law. And invariably, in all small papers across the state, women were put on the front page as drunk mom arrested. And men, it was about 9-1. Now, more men were arrested for drinking, for driving drunk with kids in the car. But it was the women who ended up on the front page. And the men just appeared in the police blotter.
Mm-hmm.
So that double standard is something that we have held on to. And if you asked me why, I would say because women, we still expect women to be these social, moral, religious arbiters in a family. We expect men to be boys. We expect men to act out. But we don't expect that of our women.
Yeah.
Even though we expect more of them than ever before, by the way.
Yes, yes. So, you know, I discovered your book through the New York Times review of books, and the thing that really made me want to interview you was their report that you don't think AA is particularly well adapted to women. So let's talk about AA in general, and of course I note that double standard really comes into play there too. But go ahead. I've been holding you off from talking about AA. Now I'm going to cut you loose.
Okay. Well, it's not, you know, as I found out, it's not because I came to this book with somebody who didn't have a history of alcohol problems or aside from my brief over drinking. I didn't really have experience in this realm, and so I just assumed, well, people go to AA and they get better, right? And because that's what I'd been exposed to, that's what I saw on television, that's what I'd read about in books, that's what people who had been to it had told me. And when I started looking at it, I went to some meetings and I thought, huh, that's kind of weird. How do people get better with this? It's a repetition of trauma over and over and over again. You hear these same stories, and it's people get to talk for 3 minutes each, and then you're cut off, and huh, how does this work? So I started looking into the science of how it works, and I soon found out that there is no science. And the reason there's no science is because it's AA can say whatever it wants, but it's a religion, and it's as easy to study in terms of scientific efficacy as is Catholicism or Judaism or Buddhism. And these are, on one hand, if we say alcohol dependence is a disease, and it is a multifaceted disease, then why do we insist that the cure for it is declaring that you're powerless, feeding all of your ego to God, praying, giving these 12 steps, I think seven of which, or at least five of which, I think it's five, have the word God in them, and which the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals for in California that rules makes rulings for all the nine westernmost states, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that it is unconstitutional to order any drunk driver into Alcoholics Anonymous because it's a breach of the First Amendment. So when I started looking for the efficacy and how well it worked, I found some really disturbing numbers. And AA is difficult to study. They don't participate in research, but even their own membership surveys show that of 100 people who go to a meeting on January 1st, only 5 will remain on December 31st.
And of course, they would probably use circular reasoning to say, well, that just shows how addicted they are.
Exactly. Yeah. Or these are people in denial, or these are people who they'll be back when they're really bad, when they hit bottom. And in fact, the whole basis of AA was really a lot of people out to kind of make a name for themselves. One of the first women to ever achieve sobriety within AA was a woman named Marty Mann, and she was very a gifted woman in the field of public relations, and she really knew how to spin a bottle because she cozied up to writers, to screenwriters. She cozied up to a writer at the Saturday Evening Post, and the writer sold a story, wrote a story. Basically, some people believe she helped him write it, just lauding the virtues of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it took off. It took off, you know, in terms of membership. It took off. There started to be movies about AA and the redemptive nature of AA. And it became a cultural trope that the alcoholic a blind man can find redemption through this group and then can see. And okay, it's great if it works for the very small, very, very, very slim minority of people who try it. But we have so many other treatments now. AA was developed by two white guys, one of whom dropped acid and had seances and was an inveterate womanizer who died of emphysema. He was never without a cigarette in his mouth.
This is Bill W.
Bill W., yeah. And he had he was on hallucinogens in a hospital trying to dry out, and he had a you know, flash of seeing God and the 12 steps. And, you know, that's not science. That's narrative. That's anecdote. That's not a protocol. That's what he experienced. That's what other people who have followed it have been able to experience. But with the caveat on people who have followed it, when you put randomly controlled double-blind trials, which you actually can't do with AA, but even, let's say you look at AA as a methodology, it comes essentially on global studies throughout the world, it comes basically dead last in terms of efficacy and long-term efficacy.
Everybody believes in 12-step programs, you know, based on AA. I have psychologist friends, I have counselor friends, et cetera, that, who, you know, have gone to Al-Anon and so on, and they swear by it.
They swear by it, and that's their anecdote, and it works for them. Mm-hmm. And I was actually at a party not long ago where a psychiatrist said, "You're absolutely wrong. AA works. I've seen it work." I said, "You just said you saw it work, but the science shows that it actually doesn't." And for women especially, the notion of saying, I'm powerless over alcohol, I need to let go of my ego, I need to give it all over to God, is something that many, many women find incredibly undermining and very, very painful.
Mm-hmm.
And AA can be sort of, you know, the whole goal, and I've heard people say this, well, she needs to be brought down a peg. Well, you know what? If she's drinking, chances are, you know, women who are at risk for alcohol abuse are women are twice as likely to be depressed. They're twice as likely to be diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. They're far more likely than men to have been sexually abused and far more likely than men to have had an eating disorder. These are all major risk factors for women.
Yes, yes.
And on top of that, women are coping with so many different roles today. Men typically are still the breadwinners of their family. And even though there are a lot of stay-at-home dads out there today, and that's great, typically, men are still the largest wage earners of the family. If women work, they tend to make less money than their husbands. And they are still doing the lion's share of the domestic duties. They're still the ones caring for elderly parents who may live across the country. We don't have the same tight-knit families that our parents enjoyed. We have kids' activities that are so far out of control that you've got travel soccer, you've got travel hockey, you've got, you know, a million different things the kids are doing. So you don't have any free time. And the kids don't have time to help around the house with their chores because they don't have any free time. So who ends up doing that? The mom. And she ends up folding clothes and trying to work on her brief and trying to go grocery shopping and try to make lunches. And even if her partner helps, the level of guilt that women feel for not doing everything the way they feel they should be doing it is enormous. And that's where alcohol comes in. Well, all right, I'll just pour myself a little glass. Well, all right, that felt good. I'm going to pour myself another little glass. And on it goes until sometimes there is a problem. And it doesn't mean that those women who are over drinking are alcohol dependent. It means that they're in a bad habit that they can change. And you, as a psychologist, know that there's so much new behavioral work that people are able to do today. There's cognitive behavioral therapy. There are moderation techniques. There are harm reduction techniques that are used throughout the rest of the world with enormous success. And we don't employ those with the regularity that other nations do because we are stuck on this abstinence model.
Yes, you mentioned harm reduction, and in the book you mentioned Alan Marlatt, who I think was kind of maybe the originator or at least the big researcher of the harm
reduction. Absolutely.
And I actually interviewed him, and so I was shocked to read in your book that he's passed on.
Oh, it was very sad. He died a couple of years ago, very quickly. He had cancer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and far too young. And he really changed the paradigm in this country. And, you know, not surprisingly, I think it's really, frankly, worth noting that he was Canadian. And he didn't have the whole 12-step narrative. He came at the notion of alcohol abuse and drug abuse really as an empiricist and looking and thinking about what works, what will work, how can we help solve this problem? Because this abstinence-only, one-size-fits-all model is not working for everybody. So
yeah.
We need to change the tools we have, and we got to put other stuff in the toolkit.
Yeah,
and he did. God love him. He did.
Yeah, your final chapter looks at 21st century alternatives to AA, and that's one of them. And another one that you mentioned is naltrexone, and that's another interview I did with a Dr. David Sinclair.
Oh yeah.
He's an American, but he's heading up, I think, an institute in Finland, and I believe he's using naltrexone, and I don't recall the interview. It's some time back, but I somehow have the impression that Finland was a lot more open to this research.
Absolutely.
And this approach. Yeah.
Absolutely. Because we, even though the United States, the Federal Food and Drug Administration, approved the use of naltrexone in the treatment of alcohol dependence in 1994, we American doctors prescribe it with only the ideal of abstinence, the goal of abstinence in mind. You take this drug, it's an opioid antagonist. So if you take the drug, Sinclair prescribes the drug an hour before a person is supposed to drink or is considering drinking. And what it does is that it blocks the brain's ability to release endorphins. Alcohol releases endorphins. So it blocks the brain's ability to release those endorphins. So if you take the drug an hour before you're about to drink, you're not going to get high. You're not going to get that euphoria that you feel after you have a glass or two or three of wine. You're going to maybe feel a little bit, but it's not going to have the same impact that it would if you were not taking the drug. So he prescribes that drug for drinkers in Finland and has had an enormous success rate, published in peer-reviewed journals, published in the Oxford Journal. You know, it's not like a bingo journal. It's Oxford.
Yeah.
and that show a 78% reduction in the number of drinking days and the number of drinks consumed. So this is the use of a drug for harm reduction. It allows a drinker to drink in a controlled manner that is hurting no one. The drug is available generically. It's been around since 1963. It has very few side effects. In fact, many doctors have told me that it is safer to use than, much safer to take than over-the-counter Tylenol, which is very dangerous, and it's far more free of side effects than the statins, which are the most prescribed drug in the country. So why don't we use it the way that it's used in Finland and now other countries in Europe? Well, because we think that people, if they have a drinking problem, should swear off alcohol forever. And we need to change that because it's not working.
Yeah, AA has really programmed us to accept as an article of absolute faith that once you've been an abuser of alcohol, you cannot become a social drinker.
Absolutely. That's what they believe. In fact, I had people in the AA office tell me that my period of, you know, whether it was 3 weeks or a month of drinking slightly more than I should have was a dangerous sign that I had beaten the path of alcohol dependence in my brain, and that one day it was going to sneak up on me because it was a progressive disease. And that is just not rooted in science. That is like saying to somebody, and the tooth fairy is going to come and get your tooth tonight if you leave it under your pillow. That's not science. For 95% of people who drink too much, that is not true. That may have been the case of that woman whose first, as she told me, her first experience getting drunk was when she was 14. And she loved it so much it changed her life. Well, my first experience getting drunk was when I was 18, and I hated it so much I didn't drink for 4 years afterwards. So that's kind of a different, that's what happened to you. That's not what happened to me. And it's really kind of a tautology of, okay, well, this is my experience, and this is the experience of the other people in the room. Therefore, it's everybody's experience.
Yeah.
You're a psychologist. You know how to read. You know how to read studies and analyses. That's not science. That's right. A story.
And so do you, evidently.
Yeah. Oh, yes, I do. I've become very, very, very interested and extremely curious about how science is reported in the public, in the mainstream press.
Yeah, and we need more of that kind of reporting that you're doing. You know, I mostly interview psychologists, psychiatrists, analysts, and so on. But I have interviewed a few journalists, and I think that journalists play such an important role that you come to it with, you know, that good journalists who have come to it maybe more objectively.
Well, you know, initially when I started writing the book, I thought nobody's going to believe me because this is not an addiction memoir. And the more I went into the reporting, the more I realized, well, you know what, actually that's good that I'm reporting this objectively. And I have strong feelings about it. I have strong feelings about the way AA has sold itself as is the only way that people can get better, and I think it's very dangerous. And also, a lot of women get hurt. A lot of people get hurt in AA. 12% of the AA membership are convicted felons, and they are released from prisons, particularly in California, where you have an enormous overcrowding problem. They are released into the general public to attend AA as part of their parole plea bargaining, and they go out and abuse people. There are sex offenders, there are financial criminals, and they are, because of their felonies, they can't necessarily get jobs, so who are they going to prey on? The vulnerable people in AA, the newcomers. Hey, I'll show you the ropes.
Wow, that's a...
Why don't we spend some time together? I'll show you the ropes.
That's a sobering note.
But it's really it's a documented trend.
Well, you know, this is probably a good place for us to wrap it up. We've really only scratched the surface of your book because there is so much more in terms of rich detail and historical facts. So does this feel like a good place to wrap it up?
Yes, it does. It does. And I appreciate your having me on. It was a lot of fun, and you are a great reader.
Well, thank you. So Gabrielle Glazer, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad I chanced to see that little blurb in the New York Times review of books. Unfortunately, there was not a full review, just a little note that it was a book of interest. It did mention that the author thought AA a bad match for women in general. It was that comment that really snagged my interest. Fortunately, I was able to reach out to Gabrielle, and she immediately and affirmatively responded. You may recall from my reading of her bio that she earned both her BA and master's degree in history from Stanford. Those are excellent credentials, as is her work on the New York Times, for doing the kind of historical research that was needed for this book. As you heard me say, I really appreciate the sort of perspective that a well-trained and seasoned journalist can bring to our psychological explorations on Shrink Wrap Radio. They are able to gift us with an outsider's view, and that's something that can help to keep our explorations on track, and to some extent, even to keep the fields of psychology and psychotherapy on track. If you're interested in doing some collateral listening, let me recommend three of my past interviews, which I think you'll find quite relevant. First is Shrink Wrap Radio number 183, Mindfulness, Harm Reduction, and Relapse Prevention with Alan Marlatt. The second one is Shrink Wrap Radio number 64, The Sinclair Method for Treating Addiction with Dr. David Sinclair. And finally, Shrink Wrap Radio number 331, A Jungian Approach to Addiction with David Shane. I highly recommend this book to all who are interested in alcohol use and abuse, as well as a female perspective on some of the major cultural changes that are impacting and have impacted women in these United States. I learned a lot from my reading of this book, and I'm sure you will too. Once again, Gabrielle Glaser, which is spelled G-L-A-S-E-R, is the author of Her Best Kept Secret, Why Women Drink and How They Can Regain Control. And as always, you can use the Amazon widget on our site, should you decide to order it. By the way, you'll need to scroll further down in the right-hand sidebar of our site than in the past to see that Amazon widget.
Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for a while, so I thought it was high time for me to make a donation, for a couple of reasons. First of all, you've pointed me in the direction of some very interesting authors, whose books I have bought and obviously paid for, so I figured it was only fair that you get a reward for your own work. And secondly, these long, in-depth interviews are sort of a niche format, produced almost exclusively by independent podcasters who rely on individual donations to cover their own costs. So I'd like to appeal to all your listeners to step up to the plate and make a donation. Thank you very much for all your good work.
Thank you, Mike, for that wonderful endorsement and call to action. I hope you'll respond to Mike's example and appeal. Donate today and get your name on the honor roll, which you'll find when you roll over the support tab. And I thank you in advance. Let me remind you again of a new feature on our homepage, which is our YOP poll, where I will be asking a question from time to time and you can cast your vote. As I said last time, if you've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for any length of time, or you go back to some of the older shows, you know that I used to play a brief excerpt of the interview at the beginning of the show and then follow with, that was the voice of, and among radio professionals, this is known as a billboard. And I thought it was a cool thing to do when I learned about it. I thought it would give the listener an idea of what to expect and hopefully whet his or her appetite for more. Well, after doing this for a few years, I got some advice from a terrestrial radio expert who said I was taking too long to get into the actual interviews. More recently, it's been suggested to me that I go back to having the billboard snippet of the interview to come. So I've installed some polling software on the Shrink Wrap Radio site over on the right-hand sidebar, and I'd really like you to go there, find the poll. You'll have to scroll way down. You'll see it right under that little box ad for Stitcher, and it's got a red line drawn around it. It says YOP poll or YOP poll, and it asks if you want the billboard to come back. Yes, no, or fine either way. Creating the billboard does mean a little bit more work for me, but I'm fine going back to it if that's the way the vote turns out. So please take the time to vote so that I'll know your preference in the matter. And please do it soon, because I do have another pressing question that I'm just itching to put to you. And by the way, There are now 9 votes there, but that's still hardly enough to give me the guidance I need. And if you just go there to place your vote, you'll be able to see how those 9 votes are distributed so far. So let your curiosity drive you there. I should note that I've also been making some minor changes to the website. Some of our authors have paid a small stipend to have their book advertised for 3 months or more in the right-hand sidebar. Their books were getting pushed down the page by links to affiliate organizations and so on. So now the books start appearing right under the support button. The Amazon widget for ordering books on our site or anything else you want to order from Amazon appears just below those book ads, and the Yop poll that I mentioned earlier is even further down. In the left-hand sidebar, you'll notice some of the links to strategic partners and so on that used to be over on the right. Please remember to tell your friends, colleagues, family, strangers in the street, professors, and so on about Shrink Wrap Radio. And I really appreciate it when you mention it on your blog, Facebook, or Twitter. And by the way, if you are not subscribed to Shrink Wrap Radio, it costs you nothing to do so. It just means the episodes get automatically delivered to you, and it does help me to track our audience size. And the easiest way to subscribe is through iTunes, and there's a subscription link to iTunes in the right-hand sidebar of the Shrink Wrap Radio website. I think it's pretty far down now. Speaking of iTunes, if you love this show and you haven't posted a review on iTunes, please do so. I believe our positive reviews there are one of the things that keeps us on the front page of their higher education shows. Finally, let me mention that as I record this, Christmas is but 2 days away. There's still lots to do. We're going to have a big family celebration here. By the time that you hear this, however, Christmas will have come and gone, and I hope you had a wonderful holiday.
Hi, this is Christopher Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Chris, father of our newest grandchild, Alexandra Van Nuys. Now let's hear some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Jimmy, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio and Wise Counsel when it existed for several years now. I actually chipped in with a small donation a few months ago. I really enjoy the podcast. I make my living selling palm leaf hats in Guatemala, an outgrowth of a pioneering fair trade organization, Pueblo to People. But I have long-term interests in psychology and the mind, which your show feeds. I just listened to episode number 349, Intuition and Dreams with David Sowerby, today. I have a phone app that downloads your podcast and others that I listen to when I have the time. So this one popped up today. You noted at the end of the podcast that your guest, David Sowerby, had referenced William James several times, and you asked if listeners would be interested in an episode devoted to William James. I would. I had purchased James' The Varieties of Religious Experience more than 40 years ago when I was in high school. I've kept it on my bookshelf all these years but didn't get around to reading it until last year. I had listened to a fair amount of it in the form of an audiobook I downloaded from LibriVox. But in the fall of 2012, Mark Ryan, whom I know through the local Insight Meditation of Houston, offered a course in the Varieties at the Jung Center. I was surprised to find the Varieties to be as much, if not more, philosophical than psychological. Dr. Ryan is an American intellectual historian, formerly at Yale University, now living in Houston. He's a transpersonal psychology explorer and sees James as having laid some of the foundations for that discipline. He also spoke to us about the connection between William James and Carl Jung, with James having given Jung some of the ideas he is most known for, such as the collective unconscious, he puts in parentheses, if I'm not mistaken. With my interest in James thus sparked, I have since read The Principles of Psychology, Pragmatism, and the collection of essays in the book entitled The Will to Believe. I was amazed to read in The Principles ideas that are still being investigated and discussed. The Principles, too, was very philosophical. I find his philosophy brilliant and inspiring. I heard one philosophy professor on a YouTube video say that William James was the most important American philosopher. I would suggest Mark Ryan as a possible guest for Shrink Wrap Radio. He gives another course on James at the Jung Center this fall, but I did not participate in that one. Ryan has an abiding interest in transpersonal psychology and in the work of Stan Grof and holotropic breathwork. He did a course at the Jung Center in the spring of 2013 on holotropic breathwork, which included a session with Stan Grof appearing through a virtual connection. He shares many of your interests. And then Jimmy goes on to give me a link to Dr. Ryan on the Wisdom University website. I really appreciate that, Jimmy. Thank you so much for taking me up on that question about whether people would be interested in hearing about William James. And although I only have a vote of one, it's a strong vote. I really like the fact that you've dug up a great resource, and I know I'm way undereducated in that area, so I have a personal interest in following up on this. Okay, let's move on to another one. This one is from Dara, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Dara says, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I just made the guilt-free donation of $12 to Shrink Wrap Radio. Great idea, by the way. I have a goal over the next year to be at a place professionally in which I feel confident enough to suggest myself as a future guest. I'm a licensed professional counselor in Colorado and have an area of specialty in working with transgender clients, a topic I don't think I've heard covered on the show. I have a blog called Conversations with a Gender Therapist, which I just began in June, and want to have more content on it, as well as perhaps an ebook, articles, etc., before I feel my biography would be padded enough to be considered for being interviewed on Shrink Wrap. I thought you'd appreciate hearing that a listener is using you and your show as a beacon for goal setting. Also, this way we have already made first contact by the time I contact you again in the coming year. Thanks for all that you do. I'm so happy I discovered Shrink Wrap through my Stitcher app about 2 years ago. Be well." And that's from Dara Hoffman Fox, licensed professional counselor. Well, Dara, I think it's a wonderful suggestion, and I will look forward to being contacted by you. I think it's a great topic. We touched on it in my interview about the Tarot with social worker Andy Matzner. Finally, here's one more about disturbing developments at the former Institute of Transpersonal Psychology in Palo Alto, California, now known as SOFIA University. This longtime listener, who wishes to remain anonymous, writes, "I know from your show that you have a holistic orientation and are familiar with the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology and transpersonal psychology in general. I'm writing to inform you of the current upheaval taking place on campus. The turmoil, which started 2.5 years ago with the hiring of a new president, Neil King, threatens the continuity of the university. This week, both ITP's founder, Bob Frazier, and the provost, Paul Roy, were fired, along with several other long-standing professors and administrative staff for their roles in protesting the current president's direction and lack of transparency of the board. These firings have large costs in terms of the time and money to ITP students who have lost members of their dissertation committees. We have several complaints filed with the Attorney General's office, and students are holding rallies to save the university. Neil King has agreed to step down as president in January of 2014, but has elected his own successor without input from the students or faculty. Despite bylaws that ask for between 9 to 34 board members, the board of directors now contains only 4 members, including Dr. King, 3 of whom were recently elected. As Bob Frazier said in a town hall meeting on December 17, 2013, "This is ITP's shadow expressing itself in a nightmare. I was wondering if you would be willing to share the news stories attached and with your podcast community, who I know to be generally supportive of transpersonal psychology. I regret tarnishing the holiday season with such sad news, and I wish you and your listener community peace. And that is from an anonymous person associated with Sophia University. And it just so happens that I received two other emails just yesterday about the situation. This author also sent links of articles that appeared about this on that you can find on your own by going to paloaltoonline.com. Palo Alto is spelled P-A-L-O and Alto, A-L-T-O, paloaltoonline.com. And if you type in Sophia, S-O-F-I-A, as a search term, you should be able to find the ongoing coverage of this crisis. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send emails, as always, to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And you can leave voice messages on my message phone at 206-350-9918. Thanks to today's guest, journalist Gabrielle Glazer, for sharing her work on women, alcohol abuse, and Alcoholics Anonymous. On the next episode, I'll be speaking with noted couples therapist and author, Dr. Sue Johnson, about her 2013 book, Love Sense, the revolutionary new science of romantic relationships. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.